Okay, we have a lot of ground to cover today, so we're going to be talking about a lot of material. Some portions of the Gospels from here on out, first 2 weeks, I've gone into a lot of detail, covered verse by verse to lay a lot of the background for things. Now we're getting to the point, going to have to pick up the pace some, so I'll be summarizing some areas, starting with what we'll be talking about today. We'll be beginning on page 12 of your Harmony of the Gospels, where we left off last time. We spent a lot of time last time talking about Jesus Christ's baptism, about the Holy Spirit descending as a dove, about several examples of remez that took place in there, about two witnesses that Jesus is the Son of God. Picking up the story here in John 1, verses 35 through 51, just going to summarize most of this section here. We see here that John the Baptizer, John the Immerser is what it would have meant in Greek, the baptizer. So he is standing with two of his disciples, and he sees Jesus coming, and he says, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world." You might even say that that is a remez, the Lamb of God, referring back to the Passover lambs that had been slain, as well as the sacrificial lambs slain, the millions of them over the years at the temple and the tabernacle before that. So John himself uses when I say that John uses a remez, here's an example of that. He does, who takes away the sin of the world. He's drawing a connection there between the offerings of the tabernacle and temple system there to cover sin, not that those took away sins, only Jesus Christ's sacrifice can take away sins. So the two disciples, one of them is identified in verse 40 as Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, who also becomes a follower of Jesus Christ. And Jesus gives Peter the name Cephas, or Kepha, which means stone. And Peter is Greek for stone, a pebble, a stone. Although it's not stated here, Peter and Andrew are from Capernaum, where Jesus will move to make his home base. So a couple of things we learn from this. One, I touched on this briefly in my previous lectures. We know from this that John is a rabbi also because he has disciples, as is mentioned here. The only people who had disciples were rabbis. Jesus has his disciples, 12 of whom become apostles, chosen as apostles. John has disciples, so he is a rabbi then. That's the way the system worked then. You had a rabbi, the disciples followed the rabbi. Philip and Nathanael also become disciples. Philip is from Bethsaida. Here's Capernaum on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. Here's Bethsaida, which we just mentioned. Here's Cana, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes, where the miracle of the water and the wine. Here's Nazareth, where Jesus has grown up. And again, you have this map at the back of your Harmony. Jesus is baptized somewhere on the Jordan, as we talked about last time, probably down just north of the Dead Sea. Covered that in quite a bit of detail last time. So we see a number of the disciples mentioned here, Andrew, Peter, Philip, and Nathanael. Nathanael is from Cana over here as well. We're used to pronouncing it Cana, so it's Cana in Hebrew. There's also another disciple here who is obviously present, but isn't mentioned by name. Who might that be? Well, it's John himself. John is one who is narrating. He's an eyewitness of these events. So it's obvious that this is a firsthand account of somebody who is actually there. So John is another one of these. He's apparently a disciple of John as well. I want to draw your attention to something in verse 38 here. Then Jesus turned, and seeing them following, said to them, "What do you seek?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which is to say, when translated to teacher, "where are you staying?" And then also down in verse 41, it says, "We have found the Messiah," which is translated the Christ. We see here that John inserts and translates two different terms here, rabbi and Messiah. In my first lectures, I talked about the backgrounds to the different Gospels, who wrote them, who they were written to. what does it tell us in terms of John's audience when he uses these two Hebrew terms and translates them? Well, I mentioned that John, Matthew, as I spent quite a bit of time on, is obviously written to a Hebrew audience, Hebrew/Jewish audience. The fact that John uses Jewish terms, Hebrew terms, and then translates this tells us what? Tells us he's not writing to a Jewish audience. His audience is primarily Gentile or universal because he uses Jewish terms, but he translates them. So they will understand what they mean. So this is one of the indicators, the type of subtle indicators that we see in the Gospels that tell us who the intended audience is. Just little things like that, just not a big point, but just to mention it there in passing. So he is writing primarily for a non-Jewish audience. Doesn't mean it was not for Jews also, but just that his primary audience is non-Jewish. Skipping down a little bit to verse 43, the following day Jesus wanted to go to Galilee, and he found Philip, and he said to him, "Follow me, follow me." I want to draw our attention to that phrase a bit. Got it summarized here. Verse 43, Jesus says to Philip, "Follow me." This phrase appears 19 times in the Gospels and means, is kind of a shorthand, what it means is follow me and be my disciple. It's an invitation to become a disciple of Jesus Christ. As we talked about a little bit, a disciple, the way the rabbi-disciple relationship worked is the disciple viewed his rabbi, and we see this reflected a number of times, where Jesus is called master, teacher, Lord. All of those are somewhat interchangeable terms because a rabbi was the master, he was the teacher, he was the Lord to his disciples. A rabbi would have been held in higher esteem by his disciples than his own father. The rabbi had authority over the disciple. It wasn't a slave-master relationship, but the disciples were to serve their master as well, to take care of the ordinary needs of the rabbi. A disciple was expected to follow his rabbi. So commonly, there's a phrase that was used in later writings of this period that a disciple should be covered in the dust of his rabbi. What that means is he is literally following so closely behind and beside his rabbi that he's covered with the dust as the rabbi is walking along on the dusty roads, that the dust he kicks up will literally cover the disciple. That's how close they were to be. And this is why the disciples are with Jesus 24/7. They eat meals together. They travel together. They walk together. Everything they do together. Because the goal, as I mentioned, a disciple did not want to just know what the rabbi knew, but to become just like the rabbi in every way. So in our Western minds, we tend to equate it as a teacher-student relationship, but it was much deeper than that. The disciple wanted to become just like his rabbi in every way, and that's why they follow so closely, as to be covered in the dust of the rabbi. That's why they are together 24/7, because the disciple wants to see what his rabbi does in any kind of situation, so he will know what he should do and every kind of situation there. So this is a very, very close relationship there between a disciple and his rabbi, or rabbi and talmid. It would have been in Hebrew, talmid or talmidim in Hebrew. So incidentally, Robin Weber writes a column in Beyond Today magazine, nearly every issue, titled Follow Me. And it is taken from this phrase, follow me. So these articles are basically about what it's all about to become a follower, to become a disciple of Jesus Christ. And it's taken from this phrase that appears 19 times in the Gospels where Jesus says to someone, follow me. It's an invitation to become a disciple. And of course, that is what we are to be as well, to become his disciples, to become like him in every way. We also see here, skipping down a little bit further in verse 51, This is the first of 80 times that Jesus uses the remez, the Son of Man, to refer to himself. Here's a classic example of remez here, which it points back to Daniel 7, where we have the Ancient of Days, and one like the Son of Man appears before the Ancient of Days, and to him is given a kingdom, an eternal kingdom. So this is the first of the times, 80 times, that Jesus uses this phrase. Yes, Stephen?
So I was thinking about that phrase, Son of Man. Ezekiel uses the phrase a lot as well. So why would we single that out as a reference to Daniel 7?
Ezekiel does as well, but Jesus is the Son of Man. He is that Son of Man, he is the Son of Man who is the Son of God, who does appear before the Ancient of Days. Did the disciples all catch on to that? No, they were slow on the uptake a number of times. With Jesus, it's clear that's what he is referring to. Does everybody else catch it? Not so much. Some did, but eventually they all do. Eventually they do understand. After he's crucified and appears to them, Lord, they say, Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? They finally understand that's who he is. That's what he's going to do. But at this point, no, I don't think they got it that early. Yeah, good question.
But did you say that Peter and Andrew were from Capernaum? Yeah, or were they from Bethsaida? Because it said the city of Peter.
Actually, they are originally from Bethsaida, but their fishing business is located in Capernaum, so they apparently moved to Capernaum. But yeah, good technical point. But as we'll get to, Peter has a house there in Capernaum. His mother-in-law lives there. We'll be getting to that fairly shortly here. But yeah, they are originally from Bethsaida and move over there. It's only about 5 miles apart there. And both of them are fishing ports on the Sea of Galilee, and that's their business. They are fishermen. So now we come to Jesus Christ's first miracle here at the bottom of page 12, turning water to wine. So we will go into some detail here, so let's go through this verse by verse. John 2, verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. This Cana, let's look at it again on the map. There's a town called Kerbet Cana, several miles north of Nazareth. Again, over here, you can see by the scale of miles, about 10 miles north of there. I've been to the ruins of Cana. It's not a whole lot to see today. It's just there on a hillside, has not been excavated archaeologically. Verse 2, continuing our story. Now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. I should mention here, his disciples, at this point there's only 4 or 5 of them. There's not the 12. We'll see that as the story develops. He calls other disciples as well. They were invited to the wedding, and when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." I should note here at this time, wedding feasts or celebrations lasted about a week. And obviously this wedding feast has been going on for several days because they have run out of wine. And weddings at that time were a huge social event for the village or the town. Why, it lasted about a week. It was the big event there in the community. And essentially, most of the towns or villages are in the 100 to 200 population range, something like that, the smaller ones. So basically, the whole town is invited to this celebration, and it was a matter of enormous prestige for the parents of the bride and groom to put on a big, expensive wedding there. So they would provide food and wine for basically the whole town for a week. It was a huge matter of social prestige. And if you didn't provide enough food and wine to keep all of your guests fed and happy during that time, it was considered a huge social disgrace. It was an embarrassment for the parents. So Mary, Jesus's mother, women are obviously... You haven't figured this out yet. They're much more intuitive than men. So Mary, the mother of Jesus, picks up on what is happening and realizes there's a social disaster in the making because they're several days into this week-long wedding celebration and the wine has run out. So it's going to be a huge embarrassment to the family. So she tells Jesus they have no wine. Son, the wine is run out. And verse 4, Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." And this sounds like a really rude response, translated into English this way, but it's not. It's actually a Hebrew idiom that is translated into Greek, translated into English, so it comes across rather awkwardly. The literal wording here is "what to me and you." That's literal what it says, "what to me and you," and it essentially means, "why do you involve me in this?" Or, "your concern is not my concern." It's not really rude at all the way it appears to be in English. "Your concern is not my concern." And what does this mean? Well, he answers when he says, "my hour has not yet come." That's his concern. "My hour is not yet come." And as we'll see later, Jesus is very careful at times as to when, how, and under what circumstances he reveals who he is. His divine identity, the Son of Man, the Son of God. This is just the first week of his ministry. This is apparently during the first week after he is baptized and begins his ministry. So he isn't as open about his identity, his divine identity, as he will be later on. But his mother, reading on in verse 5, clearly doesn't take his response as rude, as we'll see. His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." So his mother certainly hasn't taken his response as being rude. Now, she doesn't know what he will do, but she knows that he's going to do something, that he's going to do the right thing, which he does. Verse 6 says, "Now there were set there 6 water pots of stone according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece." So we're talking here about 120 to 180 gallons of water. Equivalent today would be roughly 800 bottles of wine. 800 bottles of wine. So just think about that. 800 bottles of wine. This is what we're talking about. Not just wine, but fine wine, the good stuff, not the Ripple, the Boone's Farm, whatever the cheap stuff could buy these days. Now, why does Jesus supply them with that much wine? Well, because the wedding feast celebration is going to go on several more days, so they need more wine. They're going to need that other 800 bottles of wine equivalent there. Now, let's talk about this a little bit from an archaeological standpoint. I mentioned earlier, a lot of my background is in archaeology. It's one of my loves. I like to bring in some evidences that illuminate the story from an archaeological standpoint. Notice here, verse 6, it says there were 6 water pots of stone. So we're talking about something, a small barrel, made of stone. Now, what were normal water pots made of? They're made out of clay. They're pottery vessels, but these are made out of stone. What is significant about this? Well, it has to do with an idea of Jewish ritual purity and Jewish thinking of that day. Stone could not become ritually unclean or impure. For instance, if let's say a mouse falls in the water pot and drowns, if that were a clay vessel, you would never be able to use that vessel again. You'd have to destroy it, throw it out, because it's become unclean because of contact with this unclean animal. If it were stone, however, that would not be the case. And these are actual stone vessels from the first century that have been, you can see they've been broken and reconstructed there. You go to Jerusalem, you can see a number of these in the Israel Museum there. They've actually found several workshops where these stone vessels were produced. And they were produced only in a very limited chronological period, basically just the first century, maybe a few years leading up to the first century. That's when this was done. So whenever they find these, they know this dates to the first century. So the Jews of that day, obviously producing stone vessels like this is very expensive to do. So it was something that was very, very important for them to do this. Well, what did they use them for? Well, they used them for ritual hand washing. Notice down here at the bottom, you see something that looks like coffee mugs. And you see one of them here actually with two handles on it. And what you would do is you would dip those stone, those are stone as well, you'd dip that stone mug into the stone vessel. Before you would eat a meal, you would pour water over your hands and ritually wash them. Let's see, Danielle and Stephen, I assume you guys went to the Western Wall and saw the Jews do that. And it's interesting, last time I was there several years ago, I actually saw plastic. They use plastic today. I guess it's it's clean. But I saw for the first time two-handle plastic mugs that they would dip. And you grab one handle and rinse your one hand. Then you set it down. Then you grab the other handle. That's why it has two handles. And you pour it on the other hand. It's interesting, using the same exact design now, 2,000 years later, as you see right here in this photograph. So that was very important, the ritual washing. We know it's important because very expensive to produce these stone vessels like that. So this whole use of these stone vessels ends in 70 AD with the destruction of the temple and of Jerusalem by the Romans then. Now, I mentioned this earlier. I'll throw in some apologetics defending the faith in the class here. A lot of Bible critics, you read them, they almost universally say, well, the Gospels weren't written in the first century, they were written centuries later by people living elsewhere in Egypt or Asia Minor or Rome, by people who never really witnessed these events. But how would somebody writing, say, from Egypt several centuries later know that the Jewish people of Galilee used these stone vessels for ritual washing at that time? Obviously, they wouldn't. Because, again, those fell out of use in 70 AD with the destruction of the temple and so on. So this again, the reason I bring this example up is it points to the fact that this is evidence that John, the writer of this gospel, certainly knew what the customs were at that time and knows they used these stone vessels. So it's something that is, again, written by an actual eyewitness of these events to record these little details in passing. He doesn't say there were water pots there. There were stone water pots, which is unusual. So this is just more evidence that the Gospels were indeed written by literal eyewitnesses there in the first century. Okay, continuing in verse 7. So Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water," and they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast." And they took it. When the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. And he said to him, "Every man at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior, then the cheap stuff." So you set out the good wine first, and after their taste buds are a little bit overstimulated or dulled, then you bring out the cheap stuff and share with them. But he says, "You have kept the good wine until now." So this is really fine quality wine that Jesus has converted the water into. "This beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples' followers believed in him." Notice here, verse 11, this says this was the beginning of signs. This word signs is a word that's commonly translated or indicates miracles, miraculous signs, in other words. So this is the first of the signs, miracles that Jesus did. Just one point in passing here, sometimes you'll see a movie or book or something, some of the apocryphal gospels, the fake gospels, we'll talk about Jesus as a child doing miracles. There's one that one in one of the apocryphal gospels that he took some mud and formed it into the shape of a bird and it flew away. Those are just nonsense. Those are written centuries later, fake gospels. But as it clearly says here, this was the first of his miracles. this is the first. No, he didn't do miracles as a child. These other apocryphal stories of healings and so on. Even one, I think, that he raised somebody from the dead when he was a child. But yeah, those are just nonsense. This tells us very clearly this is the beginning of his signs or miracles. Any other questions? Okay. Continuing our story, verse 12. After this, let's see, let me catch up here. After this, he went down to Capernaum, he, his mother, his brothers, and his disciples. And they did not stay there many days. They just go and visit there briefly. Notice also that it says he went down to Capernaum. And again, this is an indication that this is written by an eyewitness, because Cana, I've mentioned this briefly earlier, Sea of Galilee is about 600 feet below sea level off the top of my head. From anywhere around there, you have to go down to the Sea of Galilee. So they're traveling from Cana down to the Sea of Galilee. He's talking about down in elevation, again, indicating this is written by an eyewitness who knows the geography, the lay of the land. I want to do a digression here for a few minutes before our break and cover a couple of things that I wasn't sure when to cover in these classes, so this seems like an appropriate place before we get further along. Let's back up. Notice who is accompanying Jesus when he goes down to Capernaum. He, his mother, his brothers, and his disciples. Who's missing? Yes, Andrew.
His dad.
No mention of his father. Side note, no mention of sisters. Sisters, Jewish girls, as I talked about earlier, married generally in their mid-teens at that time. Presumably, his sisters are married off by this time, so they're not part of the family, but not traveling with the family. But yes, as Andrew noted, the primary person who's missing is Joseph, Jesus' father, or stepfather, I should say. He's nowhere mentioned anywhere in the events after age 12 when Jesus goes to the temple, as we talked about previously, when they go to the Passover, when Jesus is 12 years old. Joseph never appears in the Bible after that. Most scholars agree, and I would certainly agree with this too, sometime during that intervening 18 years, Joseph apparently dies because he's just not mentioned. So what does that mean for Jesus as the firstborn son? As we covered last time, he has at least four named brothers and sisters, plural, so there are at least seven children in the family. Joseph has died. Jesus, being the firstborn son, becomes the head of the family, literally the head of the family. He has these at least six younger siblings to take care of, to help take care of. And this puts Jesus in a situation where he learns things that he would not have learned otherwise. In one of the previous classes, we discussed what did he know and when did he know it? When did Jesus come to know his identity, who and what he is? Did he know it from birth? From a toddler? No, I don't think so. We cited the scripture that Jesus learned by the things that he suffered. Jesus did not know everything from birth, I think. I mean, scripture isn't explicit about it, but he learns things by what he experiences. Let's examine this from the perspective of Jesus being our high priest and intercessor. Hebrews 4 and verse 15 from the New Revised Standard Version says, "For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who in every respect has been tested as we are, yet without sin." And we read that from the perspective of yes, Jesus was tempted, tested is probably a better word. That's why I use this translation here. Yes, we know Jesus has been tempted in every way, tested in every way, but never sinned. We understand that, but this is actually saying a little bit more, if you think about it more deeply. He has experienced everything that we experience in this life. That's why he came, Emmanuel, God in the flesh. That's why God became flesh and became our high priest, our intercessor, because he's been through everything that we experience in life. He's been there. He knows what it's like. He's gone through it. How did Jesus learn a lot of the basic things that we go through in life every day? Well, with Joseph dying while Jesus is a young man, again, we don't know when, sometime between 12 and 30, did Jesus ever marry? No. I mean, there are a lot of stories out there, Dan Brown novels and all this kind of stuff that say that Jesus secretly married and had children and all this stuff. No, not at all. He never married, but did he learn family responsibilities? Yeah, clearly did. How? By becoming the head of the family after the death of his stepfather. As the firstborn son, he became the family breadwinner. He had to learn what it's like to keep a family clothed and fed with his younger siblings, for seeing that they made it off to school on time, that their lunches were packed, that they're dressed and ready for Sabbath services at the local synagogue, to see that there's food in the pantry, to set and stick to a family budget, to see that the bills are paid on time, to see that all of the many details of overseeing a family and a household are carried out correctly and responsibly. And Jesus needed to learn all of these kind of experiences and problems and challenges that we go through in this life so that we can have, as it says here, a high priest who is able to sympathize with us because he has been tested in every one of those same ways. Now, without a wife and children of his own, he became not just an older brother, but a surrogate father to his younger half-brothers and half-sisters. So although he never married physically, in this way he was able to experience what it means to be essentially a husband and father, a surrogate husband and father to the rest of his family. And in the same way, he would have learned much about another major aspect of life other than family, and that is the work world. The work world, because he would have learned what our work and employment experiences are like by assuming taking over the family business from Joseph after Joseph's death. He would have been responsible for providing for this large family, seven children, including himself, plus his mother. So providing for at least eight family members there. As a businessman operating the family business, he would have been dealing with customers. He would have been training other employees, would have been making contracts, seeing that those contracts are carried out, working with debtors, collecting bills, focusing on management and planning, and all the other details that go into owning and operating a business. And he had to learn to deal with all of these things, all these different experiences in life, the things that we have to go through firsthand, the things we experience in our jobs and our work life. There's just a great deal to learn in interacting in a business environment there, human relationships and interactions that he could not have learned any other way had he not gone through those experiences. This is a little bit of a digression, but I think it's an important digression as to what Jesus was doing in those 18 years, from age 12, the last time we see Joseph on the scene, till age 30. And Joseph is gone from the scene. So what was Jesus doing in those 18 years? I think this helps. We don't know when Joseph died. You know, maybe Jesus was 18, maybe he was 22. We just don't know. But we do know as firstborn, he would have been obligated to step in and take over the role of Jesus there in the family and to learn important lessons that he would not have learned otherwise. And he had to go through these things to become our high priest, our intercessor. He could not have learned those lessons in any other way. Any questions about that? Yes, Charles.
Being the head of the household, how would he have left for the ministry at age 30? Would he have given the role over to the next oldest brother?
Yeah,
the community might have looked down on that, maybe.
True. Possibly. Yeah. Great point. Yeah, about the community, because had Jesus just walked away and left that role without somebody else able to step in, yeah, that would have been extremely shameful, an extreme disgrace in that culture, because families were very, very close knit. Period. To walk away and abandon your family would have just been unthinkable, and Jesus would never have done that. So obviously, by this point, probably at least one or two of his younger brothers have stepped up and been ready to assume that role and taken over that. Yeah, again, sisters aren't mentioned here because they're already married and starting families of their own, and probably at least some of his brothers have stepped in. Because if Jesus is 30, yeah, just the fact that there are seven children that we know of who are born there, yeah, they're probably spaced 1 to 2 years apart. So yeah, some of Jesus' younger brothers are probably at least in their mid-20s by then and fully capable of stepping into that role as well. So yeah, great question. Shows you're thinking about the first century context of these, and that's what I'm trying to get you all to do, is think about the context as we go through these points. So, okay, well, time for our 10-minute break, so we'll see you all back here.